those of you who have not turned your cell phones, Blackberries, and all kinds of other devices to vibrate or off, but I know that was hard to do. Can you do that in the next few minutes as everybody is making their way into this room? Because I've asked somebody to actually close this door in about 30 seconds. Okay. Rabbi Sperber has graciously consented to questions and answers at the end of this, and that will be from his time allotted. So I would very much like to give him the time that he is due. Again, we're waiting for everybody to slowly and carefully make their way into this room because I don't want anybody to miss a minute of this very important session. Let me remind you that the title of this session, while you're getting yourself situated, is Why the Rambam Was Wrong. So if you think you are somewhere else, this is a good 30 seconds to be, if you were in the wrong room, nobody's looking. It's a good time to get out of here. Okay? We won't tell. So you're supposed to be, if you're here, you're in Why the Rambam Was Wrong with Rabbi Daniel Sperber. Okay. Let me not waste any more of your time and really just say again that it's truly a privilege to be in this room to introduce Rabbi Dr. Daniel Sperber. I'm going to read Rabbi Sperber's bio because I promise you I cannot possibly commit it to memory. It's too long, too impressive, and I'm just going to share it with you. Rabbi Professor Daniel Sperber is the author of the 8-volume Minhagei Yisrael on the history of Jewish customs, as well as tens of books and hundreds of monographs in Hebrew and English dealing with a wide range of halachic, linguistic, and historical subjects. Most recently, he published 2 books in Hebrew on Jewish legal thinking, The Path of Halacha, Women Reading the Torah, A Case of Psika Policy, 2007, and Ways of Psika, Methods and Approaches for Proper Halachic Decision-Making, 2008. And as if that were not enough, he was awarded the prestigious Israel Prize in 1992 and has taught at Bar-Ilan in the departments of Jewish History and Talmud since 1968. He serves as president of the Jesselson Institute of Advanced Torah Studies at Bar-Ilan. He is also the rabbi of Congregation Menachem Tzion in the Old City of Jerusalem. He studied at Yeshivat Kol Torah in Israel and Hebron, and Professor Sperber received his doctorate from the University College London in departments of Ancient History and Hebrew Studies. He served as dean of the Faculty of Jewish Studies and headed the Basic Jewish Studies program. From 1994 till 2005, he served as chairman of the chairman of the Committee on Zionist Religious Education at the Ministry of Education. And when I asked Rabbi Sperber what I should highlight this morning from his lengthy and prestigious bio, he said to tell you that his greatest contribution is that he, along with his wife Chana, are the parents of 10 children. Rabbi Dr. Daniel Sperber.
It's awe-inspiring seeing all your people. Ladies, lots of ladies, and somewhat fewer gentlemen. I'm deeply honored to be here. I think I've attended more or less all the Jaffa conferences. Maybe now you can. I'd like to begin with a clarification as opposed to an apologia. Many of you may know that for many years now I've been championing the cause of women having a greater role in ritual activities in synagogue. I've written on this subject. I've spoken in many different venues, and my words have been accepted by some with pleasure, rejected by many, obviously. But one of the criticisms that has been leveled by the Orthodox feminists has been that the subjects that I deal with are really very peripheral. Aliyot Nashim LaTorah, whether women can have an aliyah or not, is not the most central issue for Orthodox women. The way I've dealt with these problems has been within the framework of traditional halakhic thinking. What I have not been willing to confront is the basic male bias in halakha, which I think that Professor Tamar Ross calls the androcentricity of halakha. Halakha is skewed because it was formulated for the main part by males. And so rather than deal with these details of halakha, one should confront the basic question of deconstructing halakha as it exists and trying to reconstruct it in a totally egalitarian fashion. I was trained and brought up and studied all my life in a traditional fashion, dealing with traditional sources in the way in which it has always been dealt with throughout the history of rabbinic thinking. And I can't think outside that box. And I'm not willing to attempt to deconstruct the basic foundations of halakha. On the other hand, I think the many contemporary problems, whether they be feminist problems or whether they be completely different, ethical, medical, social and sociological, ecological challenges that face Orthodox Jews of the 21st century, can be dealt with and solutions can be found within the parameters of traditional halakhic thinking. The mechanism of halakha, the richness, the multi-textured nature of our halakhic heritage is so rich that it admits of a methodology that will solve most of our problems. But one of the very important byproducts of the kind of approach that I try to use, which is using the precedents found in our halakhic literature to solve in an innovative fashion the sort of problems that face us today. One of the byproducts which is essential is a new understanding, which is really not a new understanding, but the traditional understanding of how halakha really works. Let me illustrate this with two quotations, and then a third. The first comes from a great Sfaradi Posek, who lived in Algiers in the 18th century, Rabbi Yehuda Ayash. In his Sefer Beit Yehuda, or Chaim Siman Samach, he writes as follows. I'll translate it. We have not seen nor have we heard anybody who would dare to even think to change a single custom from the customs which have been accepted in the order of the service or of Kriyat HaTorah or of the order in which people are called up to the Torah. And anyone who wishes to change, to make any change, Yado ala tachtona, he's at a disadvantage. Because the erstwhile rabbis who established within their holy communities the rules and regulations were meticulous in every detail. And their rulings became so widespread that the customs that they established may not be changed in any degree whatsoever. And here he uses rabbinic phrases which are multi-meaning. Umaamidim otam bedavar hamaamid afilu be'elef lo batel. And they established them in a sort of fashion which cannot be in any way annulled. Zot Torat HaAdam HaShalem. This is the true Torah in which the deeds of our forefathers, we may not err from them, right or left, but must always rely upon them and never make any sort of change whatsoever. For if we did so, then in each generation there would be a second and a third and a new Torah. Ve'avera goreret avera. And one sin leads on to another, etc., etc. So this was a view which stated that there's a certain staticness in halakha. Nothing can change. Any change will lead to avera goreret avera, which we now call the slippery slope. Let me now give another quotation, very strangely, because it comes from one of the great halachic innovators of the last generation, Reb Moshe Feinstein. He writes in one of his tshuvot, "You should know that me'ikarei ha'emuna ha'torah, the basis of our holy belief, that the winds of time cannot bring about any change. And therefore, even im yishtaneh seder ha'chayim ba'olam, if there come about great sociological changes, and even if all the women of all times were to come together and agree upon something, lo nishtaneh din Torah ve'af lo din derabanan. Not a single biblical or rabbinic commandment could be changed. Ve'lo to'il shum milchama. And all your activism is in vain. Ki shum koach yesh leshanot afilu be'eskeim kol ha'olam kulo shum davar. It doesn't matter if all the world would agree. They could never come to a situation where they would bring about a single change from tradition. As I say, this is a strange statement because it was made by one of the great halachic innovators of the 20th century, but he was speaking, of course, against feminism. That's what he says over here. Hamilchama shel anashim. Now, as opposed to that, I want to read you a passage that comes from another great Israeli Sfaradi posek of the former generation, Reb Chaim David Halevi, the Sfaradi chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He writes, as it is extremely clear that no law or edict can maintain its position over a long period of time due to the changes in conditions of life, and that laws which were good in their time are no longer suitable after a generation or more, but require correction or change. How is it that our Holy Torah gave us righteous and upright laws and edicts thousands of years ago, and we continue to act in accordance with them to this very day, and will even continue to do so to the end of all generations? How is it that these same laws were good in their time and are good to this very day as well? Such a thing was only possible because the sages of Israel were given permission in every generation to innovate in matters of halakha in accordance with changing times and situations. And it is only by virtue of this that the existence of Torah has been possible in Israel, and that they were able to follow in the way of Torah and mitzvot. Anyone who thinks that halakha is frozen, and that one is not permitted to deviate from it right or left, is very much mistaken. This is the exact opposite of what Moshe Feinstein said and what Yehuda Ayash said. On the contrary, there is nothing as flexible as the halakha. For a teacher of halakha can rule regarding the very same question at the same time to two different inquirers and declare that something is treif to the one and kosher to the other, a thing that is well known to all those who give rulings on what is permitted and forbidden. And it is only by virtue of the flexibility of the halakha that the Jewish people have been able, by virtue of the numerous and useful innovations that were introduced by Jewish sages over the generations, to follow in the way of Torah and mitzvot for thousands of years. So we have over here two very opposing views. The view that was expressed by Moshe Feinstein, by Yehuda Ayash, and by numerous others, and of course which has its own sociological history and the reasons for it, which we won't go into now, and the new, but actually much more traditional position of Reb Chaim David Halevi, that halakha is dynamic, it changes, it's flexible, it's innovative, it confronts problems and seeks solutions, but always within the framework of traditional halakha. So, coming to our own subject, the title given was somewhat provocative, and it was actually very chutzpahdik. And perhaps we should have changed it and said, why was the Rambam wrong, or why is the Rambam wrong for our time? Because normally, an Orthodox person feels very bound, feels almost shackled by the Rambam. And it's very difficult to say the Rambam was wrong. But in this particular issue of Jewish Orthodox women in leadership roles, the Rambam seems to have been wrong, at least certainly for our time. The issue exploded several years ago when a lady called Leah Shaktiel in Israel was elected, and I use the term elected, to Moitza Datit, a religious council which is part of the municipal council in a certain town in the Negev. And the rabbinic establishment came out in a tremendous opposition to this, saying that this was absolutely unacceptable according to Jewish law. A woman could not be part of a moitza datit, of a religious council. She, being a very fighting woman, brought the issue to the Supreme Court, the Bagatz, who ruled, and of course that's our Chaot Shel Akum, that's a secular court, not a religious court, that she could serve on the Moitza Datit, and as a consequence, that started off a whole process in which women could suddenly become members of religious councils. Why then is it so frightening, threatening, that a woman should be a member of a religious council? The Rambam, in Hilchot Melachim, basing himself on Tanaitic sources, rules as follows. The verse in Dvarim says, Som tasim alecha melech. You shall surely put upon yourself, appoint for yourself a king. And the rabbi said, Melech velo malka. A king and not a queen. So the Rambam writes, Ein mamlichim melech tzechila, ela lasot mishpat u'milchama. The reason that you appoint a king is in order to carry out justice, to be the supreme judge, and to go to war. He then goes on and expands this rabbinic statement, which is found in the Sifrei, and says, Ein ma'amidim isha b'malchut. You cannot appoint a woman as royalty. Shenemar, Som tasim alecha melech, v'lo isha. V'chein, and here comes the crux of the matter. And also, Kol mesimot b'Yisrael, which you have to translate as any type of leadership role in Israel, Ein memamim bahem ela ish. You may only appoint a male. Consequently, you can't have a woman on the Moitza Datit, because she's in a leadership role. So therefore, the Orthodox rabbinic establishment said that this is absolutely asur. The Rambam said women cannot have any kind of leadership roles in Israel. The phrase mesimot, kol mesimot shebi Israel, again is taken from Tanaitic sources, but it's been here expanded by the Rambam to include women. This must have troubled many people, because it doesn't seem to make sense. First of all, historically. If we look, for instance, at Baron's great work on the Jewish community, and look in the index, you'll see that there are any number of women in Jewish history that served in leadership positions, in rabbinical councils, in synagogue councils, as presidents of synagogues, going back to the Renaissance period. Were they unaware of the Rambam statement? But let's go even further back in time. If we look at the time of the Talmud itself, we'll find that women had quite a number of leadership positions. In the Roman and the Byzantine period, we have a number of inscriptions from synagogues in which women are the archi synagogos, the presbytera, the gymnasiarchos, the aganothetes, and something which you'll understand even if you don't know Latin and Greek, the mater synagogae, the mother of the synagogue, the pateressa, which is the feminine of the pater, the mater collegi. There are more than 30 inscriptions from the Roman and the Byzantine period, from which we learn that women held important leadership positions within the synagogue itself. An archi synagogos is the president of the synagogue. And this is more or less contemporary material with the rabbinic sources that we mentioned. Remember that in the rabbinic sources, there is no statement that says that a woman cannot have a leadership position. It only says that she cannot be a queen. That's also a bit complicated because we had Jewish queens. And Jewish queens who were Shlomtzion HaMalka, who were active and who were accepted by the rabbis, and who are mentioned in the Talmud. And of course, going back in time to Dvorah HaNeviah, who was certainly a person in a leadership position. Not only was she a prophetess, but she was also a leader of the community. So the Rambam statement seems to run contrary to historical fact, to biblical sources, to archaeological sources, to historical sources of the medieval period, and I think also to common sense. So how do we deal with this situation when we have a statement by somebody who is very intelligent indeed and who is considered the premier posek for all generations? Bear in mind that most of the Shulchan Aruch is based on the Rambam. How do we deal with this situation? Well, again, the Moshe Feinstein, who we mentioned earlier, is saying that you mustn't make any sort of change whatsoever, writes, "Lo yadua li be'einai makol ledvarav." I have no knowledge of any source for the Rambam statement. And I have to assume that it was his own personal idea. If it's his own personal idea as opposed to a statement that was based on some sort of halachic source from the Talmud and so on, then, you know, he has a personal view and I have another personal view. But others said that this doesn't seem to be right, because the Rambam is very careful in his formulation, and when he has a personal view which is not based on traditional sources, he has a special formulation, which is usually Vayera Eli, and it would appear to me that. And this doesn't appear here. This seems to be a sort of an absolute statement. So, some authorities posited that he must have had a source, which was lost, or which we don't know of. In point of fact, we can actually identify such a source, because in a Byzantine source from the 10th or 11th century called the Psikta Sutrita, also called Midrash Lekachtov, which was written in the Balkan area, we find the statement, Lo tuchal latet alecha ish nochri. You cannot take a non-Jewish person again to be a king, the verse. Ze lo ta'aseh. That's a negative commandment. Ish velo isha. A king can only be a male and not a female. Mikan she'ein memanim parnasa al hatzibur. From which we learn that one may not appoint a parnasa, not a parnas, a person in authoritative position, but a woman in some position of authority over the community. It's not clear where the Midrash Lekachtov got his source from. The Rambam doesn't use the same formulation, so obviously it doesn't come directly from there, but there must have been some such source that has been lost in the meantime. Nonetheless, this source, the Midrash Lekachtov or the Psikta Sutrita, has never been a source that was used by halachists. We have many midrashim. Ein lemeidim halacha min ha'agada. We do not rule halachically on the basis of agadot and midrashim. And certainly not a late one. We're not speaking of the classical midrash, the Midrash Rabbah, Tanchuma, etc., etc. So, some authorities said, well, we don't know where it comes from. It was his own personal idea. Others say maybe it wasn't his own personal idea. He had some sort of source, but it's not one of these canonic sources. It's not a Talmudic source. It's not in the anywhere in the Talmud. Bavli, Yerushalmi, etc. So much so that some of the authorities wrote and again, it's not I that's being disrespectful. But Rav Ben Zion Chai Uziel, the Sfardi chief rabbi of Israel, great authority, wrote, Halacha zu shel Rambam hina halacha dechuya. This ruling of the Rambam, what's the chuya, is a rejected view. It's not acceptable from a halachic point of view. It doesn't go into the mainstream of halacha. Still, the rabbis found it difficult to come to terms with this statement. They pointed out that it was in contradiction to all contemporary Rishonim. The Rashi, Ramban, Rashba, Ritva, etc. And they give a list to show that this view of the Rambam is in direct contradistinction to all these major Rishonim, and therefore they're capable of saying it's a halacha dechuya. Even from a formalistic point of view, if you want to rule according to a majority of decision, this is a minority decision. But still, they were uncomfortable. So they tried to find some other way out of dealing with this Rambam statement in order to be less disrespectful. And Rav Uziel says, you know, the Rambam, you have to see the context in which this statement was made in Hilchot Melachim. And all the rulings in that particular section of Hilchot Melachim, the law concerning kings, לא נאמרה הלכה זו, אלא במינוי שנעשה על ידי סנהדרין. It's only dealing, the Rambam there is only dealing with appointments that were made by the Sanhedrin. But if there is no appointment by the Sanhedrin, אלא קבלה של הציבור, but the community elected and accepted an individual על ידי בחירות, through an elective process, והסכמה ואמונה של הבוחרים, and the agreement and the faith and confidence on the part of the electors, who have the right to determine who should look after their interests, על פי זה, in such a case, אפילו הרמב״ם מודה שאין כאן שום שמץ של איסור. Even the Rambam would agree that there is no shade of appropriation. In other words, Rav Uziel, in order to circumvent the situation in which he has to say that the Rambam is wrong, is saying that maybe, even though we don't have a source, or we don't know the source, the Rambam was speaking of a very specific situation where a Sanhedrin, which we don't have nowadays, appoints, makes an appointment. But the community has a right to elect, and that's why I used the word elect earlier on, to elect and therefore to appoint leaders or people in leadership roles to look after their own interest. So, in this way, also, a number of great authorities sought to solve other difficulties, halachic difficulties, that arose from this statement of the Rambam. The Rambam, in the same section, also states that you can't elect, appoint a king who is a geir, who is a convert, or the son of a convert. And the Nodi Bihuda, one of the great 18th century poskim, says, how could this be the case? Yerabam ben Devat, Jeroboam was the son of a convert. In other words, again, biblical precedence contradicts the Rambam statement. In a sort of a complex, conflicted argument, he suggests that it wasn't a Sanhedrin that appointed Yeravam. It was the people that did so. So, if there's an electoral process, or if the community makes an appointment, that's different from an appointment that's made by the Sanhedrin. These various arguments have had the effect of totally marginalizing the Rambam statement, making them irrelevant to the present day. We haven't contradicted the Rambam. We're not saying that he's wrong, but he's wrong for our day. We don't have a Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is not making these appointments. It appears that the Rambam was a da'at yachid, the majority of opinions of his contemporaries are quite different. Therefore, according to the classical rules of halakha, yachid barabim, halakha karabim, we would rule according to the majority view. And even if we weren't willing to take that sort of position, we would say that in any case, the Rambam was dealing with a totally different situation, which is irrelevant in the present day. So, we see that the arguments that were forwarded by the rabbinic establishment in the case of Leah Shagdiel, totally irrelevant. She didn't really need to go to the high court, to a bagatz, to argue her case. I mean, she needed to, but other rabbis should have taken up her cause. And in examining the sources, which are all very clear and evident, there's nothing strange or obscure. I haven't discovered any manuscripts that were unknown. Probably it's all available on Google. But they didn't take up the cause for all the political reasons that we know about and that were mentioned earlier today. Regretfully. Of course, if you have this view that the halakha is unchanging and you mustn't make any type of innovative process, you could argue that there were not in the past such leadership roles. We have argued that this is not the case, that there's ample archaeological, historical, textual evidence, which was obviously not available to the rabbis, the establishment rabbis of Israel at the time, who didn't read Greek and didn't know Latin and wouldn't consult Salo Barons, the Jewish community. But even if we were to accept that type of argument, that these were unusual cases, that there are only 20 or 25 inscriptions in all to base ourselves on, we would still argue that the basic premise, that which was in the past must continue into the future, is incorrect. And that the basic premise should be, as Reb Chaim David Halevi so correctly said, that in every generation there's constant change. And the halakha is the most flexible system of law that we could know. And that's why it has been able to survive for 3.5 millennia. And that's why it's a Torah Chaim, a living Torah. Eitz Chaim hu lamachazikim ba. And just as a tree has life, and it has a stem, which is our tradition, a trunk, and then it branches out in many different directions, and the leaves fall in the winter, and in the spring there are new, fresh leaves, which are not identical to the former ones. That's how the halakha works. There are roots which are rooted in the ground. There's a central stem of tradition, and there's a branching of a variety of opinions which give us the richness of halachic heritage. And there are new leaves growing in every season, depending on the climate, depending on the winds of time. There are dry seasons, which unfortunately we've been experiencing for the last 150 years since the time of the Chatam Sofer, when he said, Chadash asur min haTorah, any innovation is forbidden. And there are times when there's rain, and there's freshness, and there are new leaves, which should be our time, and it should be a part of your role. I don't want to discuss the problem of the Rabban, the Maharat. I wrote a tshuva on this. I was a signatory to Rabbah Horowitz's smicha, ordination, I discussed the nature of the ordination. I think that halakhically there's absolutely no problem involved. If we understand the nature of ordination, or of conferral, as we learned this morning, I think that the whole argument, the linguistic nomenclature of what the title is, largely irrelevant. Functionally, she serves as she serves and will continue to do so, and others will come in her after her, and there will be an efflorescence of such women. So it's not just merely a matter of poskot, yoatzot halachot, women who answer halachic questions and give halachic determinations, but of course a maharat or a rabbah, or whatever you wish to call it, or a rebbe, has a leadership position. And that is the real question. That within an orthodox religious framework, within a synagogal environment, can women have leadership positions, including the ability to give spiritual direction to their community? This might be an innovation, but there's no halachic reason that it should not be permissible. There's every social and sociological reason why this should be an aim of our generation. We have been hijacked by right-wing orthodoxy, and it's time that we liberated ourselves and had the courage to state very clearly and unequivocally that modern orthodoxy, with the ability to be innovative in halakha and to confront contemporary sociological problems and find halakhic solutions within the parameters of traditional normative halakha, that this is true Judaism, as opposed to the skewered position of the ultra-Orthodox. As long as they don't attack us, they can do what they want. As soon as they try to delegitimate us, we should join the fray and show and prove that the true legitimacy lies with us and not with them. This is the true way of halakha, this is the true way of Judaism, and we should have the courage and the unity of purpose to give clear expression to this. So, what I'm arguing is not a feminist position. I do not regard myself as a feminist, even though I have 7 girls. Only 3 boys. I consider myself as a halachist. And I think that the message that we give is a message of true halacha. But 50% of the Jewish population is certainly of the population, or maybe 52%, I'm not quite sure, should be a powerful unit to use in strengthening and legitimizing our position. Thank you.
Instead of pointing and calling, can I give you 30 seconds to just come to the aisle, and we'll take them in the order as you appear in the aisle, if that's okay? Without stepping on your neighbors, if you can do that, I think it'll be a lot easier for us. I've also asked, since I don't see microphones in the aisle, I don't know if anybody is part of the room who can tell me the facilities, if anybody from facilities can tell me if there's in, maybe one of those will work. Let's see. Okay, if we'll do it, I'm happy to hold it. If it works, that's great. If not, what I'm going to ask is for Rabbi Sperba to repeat your questions. Okay. Sorry. Thank you. Okay. I'm sorry to move this for you. I have to move it back and forth. We're going to start. I assume you're standing there. Okay. I'm going to try to pass the mic and do this as orderly as possible. We have about, I would say, 8 minutes to do this before we have to vacate this room. Okay. Let me try to do this.
Rabbi Sperber, thank you for your talk. Are the halachic authorities you mentioned as contrary to the Ramban, Rashi, Ramban, I think you said Rishba. What do they say? Do they say it's allowed? Do they? What is the essence of their position? Thank you very much.
They say that the statement in the Sifrei, which the Rambam begins with, deals only with a question of a queen. They then go on to say that even this statement has to be modified because of Shlomtzion HaMalka, and therefore they find a way of showing how this ruling is not always applicable. They then go on to say that what the later authorities say, that when there's a communal appointment, this ruling is not applicable. All these statements are made and have been spelled out by Rav Uziel in his tshuva on the subject.
I apologize. I've just been given the notification that I'm only allowed to have one more question. We'll see how fast this goes. Maybe we can sneak in a second while they're not looking.
I'm afraid this is a large question, so it may not fit in the time allotment. I guess my question relates to, as you said, taking on the right-wing elements within Orthodoxy. In a sense, it seems like the Rabbanut in Israel is holding all of American Orthodoxy hostage with issues of conversion and such, and even rabbis who are prepared to take a stand risk delegitimizing their whole movement, and it's kind of a cascading feature. So how would you say this could be addressed?
I've spoken and written copiously on the subject, and I'm what happened when, what I said was that we were hijacked by the ultra-Orthodoxy. And we were hijacked by the ultra-Orthodoxy means that we were hijacked also in the Israeli rabbinate. The Israeli rabbinate, the chief rabbinate, and the Moetzat HaRabbanut HaRabshit is no longer an independent body which thinks independently. It's totally dependent upon the views of Rabbi Yoshiv and of the Moetzat Gedolei HaTorah. For political reasons, which we obviously can't go over into here, they're appointed politically, they depend upon the sort of coalition situation, and therefore they don't think independently. And the only people that speak their own mind are those people who are independent rabbis and not dependent, not part of the establishment.
Kvod HaRav, This is just to clarify, if you made the position of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein as far as women in leadership positions, I am personally aware of an organization that I'm involved with, the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists. Dr. Nora Smith was our president long before I became a doctor. She recently retired, and it was presented to Rabbi Moshe, and he ruled that a woman may, in fact, be a leader of a Jewish organization. This was this was facilitated by Rabbi Moshe David Tendler. Are you aware of this? Is this in writing?
Not only am I aware of the fact, but the fact is that he has a tshuva in which he wrote that women could be mashgichot kashrut, and obviously a woman who's a mashgich kashrut has an authoritative position because she can close down shops and so on and so forth. And I mentioned the fact that part of his argument was that he knows no source for the Rambam, and he thought that this was his own personal position. I said that that's interesting because on the one hand he makes this statement that you can't be innovative, on the other hand, as I mentioned, he was extremely innovative. And the idea that women should be able to be mashkichot kashrut, which might seem to be common sense to us, it's very simple, for him was a tremendous innovation and a courageous move.
I'd like to thank Rabbi Sperber and thank all of you for being here.